Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing well, Justin. How are you?
I am doing great. Do we have any announcements?
If you're a listener of this show, make sure you're subscribed. Again, we've had some people write in and say, I wasn't getting the new episodes, or I didn't know if you guys had taken a long break. We take a break once in a while, but if it's iTunes, Spotify, whatever it is that you listen to us on, make sure you're subscribed.
I do have one thing that I wanted to talk about before we got into tonight's case. Our friends over at Thinking Sideways are packing it up and ending their show, which is really sad, I realize. And we wanted to tell them how much we appreciated them, their show, our friendships. I remember when I first started listening to them, I always loved their more mysterious episodes like The Hum, Cicada 3301, The Bloop, Denver Airport. But it was around episode 127, Lake City Quiet Pills, that that's when I started tweeting at them and sending them pictures, because that is right down the street from my house. So I drove over to the Lake City ammo plant and took a picture of myself standing out in front of the secured area. I would make a trip out to Oregon and meet them. Hilariously enough, I had Steve and Joe confused. I had never seen an actual picture of them because they concealed their identity, but there was a cartoon drawing of them that was very much of their likeness. And I just had the two confused. So it was a paradigm shift when I first heard Steve speak, and I said, no, you're Joe. But I went on and was their intern on their Casey Nicole episode, which is a short episode between 148 and 149, I think. So I'm really saddened to hear that they're going away. I know that they're going to still be around, so hopefully we can all still interact, but I just wanted to give you guys a shout out and tell you farewell, and you will be missed.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling T-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about a case from the 1980s, and it's a case involving two young lovers and murdered parents.
I'd never heard of this case before, so I went into it completely unbiased, just like the Scott Watson case. I really don't have any sort of emotional investment in this, so I really look at this case with an unbiased eye.
Yeah, we had a number of people writing in about it, but lately there was a documentary released on Netflix, so some people might be thinking that we're covering another Netflix case, but really, this is an older case, and it's been covered a number of times. I just found it pretty fascinating when I was reading over the accounts of what may have occurred, and then the subsequent trial and everything that happened after that. This is a really interesting case because if you're one of those people who gets emotionally invested in court cases and in trials that involve someone proclaiming their innocence and accusations of prosecutorial misconduct, this is a good case for you.
So when and where did this take place?
This happened in the year of 1985. In this case, we'll be talking about a woman by the name of Elizabeth Haysom. And Elizabeth Haysom met a young guy at the University of Virginia named Jens Søring. Jens was interesting to Elizabeth because he had a musical background. He had a writing background. She was into writing. I guess you could say they sort of hit it off, even though they weren't to spend a lot of time together right away. But it's just one of those things where two people meet and then they sort of end up in each other's heads and they can't stop thinking about each other. So they start writing to one another. Both of them are at this university, and by virtue of their scholarships, obviously were expected to do great things.
But they were definitely a little bit of an odd couple because she was more of a free spirit and wouldn't hold back if it was a party time or something like that, whereas Jens is more reserved and I guess more philosophical or more bookwormy. I don't know. So I always thought that their relationship was a little odd, but
Elizabeth had a bit of an English accent, or what they say is an English-y accent.
She was like a exchange student over in England for a while, where she picked that up.
And Jens was German.
Now, Jens, even though he's German, he speaks pretty good English. Although if you see interviews with him now, he'll speak in German mostly. It's sort of weird. People think that he's covering up something because of his, you know, flipping back to his native tongue, but he speaks English just fine.
Yeah, I think he speaks quite well. And whenever he speaks in English, I can make out everything he says, no problem. So I encourage people to watch videos that contain interviews with him. They met in late 1984, correct? They met at an orientation at that university. By the next year, her parents met up with them. It was just one time.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about Elizabeth Haysom's parents here, Derek and Nancy Haysom. I do want to say before we continue that Derek and Nancy both had families before and been divorced before they married. They had children that they each brought into the marriage, but the only child they ever had together was Elizabeth. Just so as we go on and we talk about the other people who are siblings of Elizabeth's, they came from her parents' former marriages. They didn't seem to like Jens that much, but I think it was mostly because they were looking at him as, oh, he could potentially be a long-term boyfriend or marry our daughter, and they didn't really like him for that.
That's such a reverse psychology thing. Normally, if your daughter's dating a guy who's somewhat well put together and intelligent, that would make you happy because he's not a screw up. He's not a total dirtbag or whatever. So I'm surprised that they don't like him, because if they don't get along with him, even if he is a clean cut guy, thinking, well, our daughter could do better, I understand their philosophy.
I believe it had something to do with his social interactions, because socially he wasn't as well put together as Elizabeth was. So he seemed awkward at times.
Oh,
and I think that threw them off. And so they didn't know if he was, I don't know, nervous because he was hiding something or what. So it was definitely one of those things where they got a vibe from him and they just didn't like it. And it was also known that in 1985, he ended up going to Elizabeth's parents' house with her when they weren't around.
Yeah, he never was in the house, I guess, when they were there, according to him. It seems that she wasn't that close to her parents, or didn't bring her friends around her parents very often.
At some point, and this is in December of 1984, Elizabeth wrote a letter to Jens. And I think this is significant because this is before they really spent more time together.
Before they called it monogamous or whatever, yeah.
And this is the letter that she ended up leaving in his room. "I hated my love for you for a long time. I hated myself for discovering vulnerability, but as the weeks passed, I began to understand. I had always believed that I made men fall in love with me so that I could take out all the hatred I felt for them by humiliating them. I despised their cheap lust and easy passions, and in the end, I made them hate themselves for loving me and the torture I inflicted. I would make a man humiliate himself to obtain me. I would give him the best, and I'll use a different word here, sex he's ever likely to get, and then walk out. I love you, and it may alter intensity and direction from time to time, but I will always love you with a part of me which no one else will be able to snatch." So this is a declaration, Justin. She's saying, "You're my guy."
Yeah, yeah.
That's powerful, right?
Mm-hmm.
If he's only even halfway interested in her, this would probably knock him over, right?
Well, I think he was more than halfway interested. So this is confirmation to him that she's going to take this relationship as seriously as he probably already was. I feel that he was already head over heels for her. I would almost say that she might have been out of his league a little bit. He's happy about this.
Right. But this is a powerful moment. It's where, like you said, now he's definitely locked onto her. As we go on into 1985, he really believes that they're going into the future together. Where were Jens and Elizabeth on March 30th of 1985?
There's multiple stories here, but Jens says that they were at a hotel in DC and that they were going to see a movie that night.
It was Porky's Revenge, right?
If that was, I don't know if it was Porky's or the sequel, but yes, it was one of those horrible movies. And then they were going to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Now, the reason I ask, Jens says that they were in DC.
Yeah.
And what does Elizabeth say?
Depends on which statement you're going with, but her final statement or testimony is going to be that
she was in DC and Jens got a rental car and drove to her parents' house.
Okay, so they had rented a car to travel to DC, but one of them probably wasn't really in DC on that day.
Yeah, they essentially are trying to be an alibi for the other, but one of them's not there. So you have her version, which is, I was in DC and Jens was driving around in my rental car, or Jens's version is, I was in DC and she took off with somebody else and went to her parents' house.
This is important because on March 30th of 1985, in Lynchburg, Virginia, at the home of Derek and Nancy Haysom, their bodies are discovered.
Yeah, they've been stabbed to death. It's a brutal scene.
Now, Derek was stabbed 36 times, maybe?
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
it was well over 30 times. And his wife had been stabbed about 6 times.
Yeah,
both of them had their necks cut pretty deep from side to side.
It was, yeah, ear to ear. Their home is, what, a good 2 hours from DC? It's a long drive.
And it's set way back. I mean, it's almost like you drive through some pretty wooded country getting to their home.
Yeah, it's like the scene of the Shining or Get Out when you're, you know, driving up through the wooded area, you know, all the way into the mountains to go to some house that's very remote.
It was their retirement home. At the scene, the investigators are trying to put it together, like what happened here. Their first thought is, it seems to be, that whoever did it, this was a very, I guess you could say, a rage murder almost. Someone got really personal with them with the knife.
Yeah, I mean, they disregarded a break-in and a robbery and stuff pretty quick because there wasn't a lot missing. And somebody that breaks into a house to steal things usually doesn't do this. They might attack you and then run off, but they don't brutalize everybody in the home the way these two parents are.
So Derek was found on his left side in the doorway between the living room and the dining room near a fireplace. And Nancy was found on the kitchen floor. She was face down,
kind of behind a table.
There were, as if someone had taken blood and swirled it around her body.
Yeah, you can interpret it two different ways. Either somebody swirled the blood in a artistic fashion, or they were cleaning up their bloody footprints.
It appeared to investigators that whoever had killed them had actually sat down at their table with them. It was set for dinner, right?
Yeah.
Or at least a meal. Mm-hmm. Someone, whoever had done this, had actually sat with them. So it almost seems like they were invited into the home and sat there. So they must have known their killer.
Yeah, there was no signs of break-in or forced entry. And Nancy was wearing her, like, evening, you know, like, nightgown or robe, you know, very casual. So it's not a stranger that they're inviting in, because she probably would have gone and changed. So it's somebody they know, and somebody that they let into the home.
They found evidence that Derek had been stabbed as he was getting away from the actual table. So he might have been stabbed while he was at the table and then tried to get away and was followed and finished off in the other room.
Yeah, he had a lot of defensive wounds on his hands, even grabbing the knife with one of his hands. It was pretty gruesome.
They said that he had even touched one of the chairs. So there was evidence that he actually grabbed onto that chair, maybe to keep himself from falling.
But with two victims, this seems that I think one person is capable of this, because something horrific happens, people freeze. But it appears that there's two assailants or two murderers, two perpetrators here, and you have two victims that are stabbed in different ways. So there's evidence here that two people did this, and it would be a little hard to take out a full-grown man and then turn around and go after the woman without her running off, but she could have froze.
But there is a great difference between the two victims here. One was stabbed
over 30 times. Yeah.
Yeah. Was stabbed over 30 times. And then his wife was stabbed about 6 times. So that's quite a difference. Now, it was Nancy's friend, Annie Massey, who had discovered them, but she didn't discover them until April 3rd, 1985. So this March 30th is their best guess on when this went down.
And at night, just because of the way they were dressed and the last time anyone had heard from them. Initially, the investigators went to question the children of the family. You know, they just start with next of kin. A lot of the siblings live in Canada, and just a couple live down in the States. So they start with Jane, the daughter, and Jane's not exactly all there, or she has some kind of wild stories. They find out that Jane has a history of being involved with a religious cult, whatever that means. Jane is not being quite upfront with them. Now, the investigators are looking at this weird blood pattern around the bodies. Also, there was a V on her father's chin, like carved into his chin. And whether this was intentional or just a flurry of stab wounds, it's unclear. And then there was blood smeared around the bodies. And that the bodies are facing in a northerly direction. So they're thinking this might be a ritualistic killing and might have some sort of cult connection. The investigators took this to a cult expert, and they confirmed that this looked very shady and possibly something to do with the devil or Satan worship. So Jane is the one that they start with. After pretty intense questioning of Jane, Jane informs them that Elizabeth had said something very odd to her. She had, I guess, grabbed her by the hand, looked her dead in the eye, and said, "I'm the devil, and you're my sacrificial lamb," which is sort of insinuating that Elizabeth is going to make Jane out to be the perpetrator of something.
Ouch.
And Jane and the other siblings all know that Elizabeth is, I won't say the black sheep of the family, but she's the one that manipulates. She's the one that lies. She's the one that causes the most trouble. They are more or less directing the investigators to Elizabeth because they're like, "We didn't do this. And if you think a sibling did this or somebody that knows the family did this, then we all think it would be Elizabeth that did."
And Elizabeth was the one that had been staying there.
Yeah.
So it does make sense.
It does. When they initially question Elizabeth, she's telling them that she wasn't around that night and she was seeing movies in DC.
Now, months later, and this is, you know, they spoke with her following the murders, October 12th and 13th, somewhere in there, Jens and Elizabeth head to Europe.
Well, there's a little bit leading up to that. The investigators start questioning them. They're questioning Jens, and he's saying, "We were in DC. We had a car." He's giving them information, but when it comes down to, "Well, we're 99% sure that you're not responsible for this, Jens, but we have to exclude you, and we need a blood sample, and we need your fingerprints to get that last 1%. And Yin says, "You know what? Let me think about it," because he's talking to them mostly over the phone. And he says, "Maybe on Wednesday I'll come down to the station and give those things up." Come Wednesday, they're flying to London. So it was October 9th when they fled the country. At this point, even though the investigator said, "I'm pretty sure that you are not responsible for this," well, now, with him fleeing the country, he's their prime suspect. And they absolutely think he had something to do with this, which makes sense, but we don't have a lot connecting him to the murder yet besides Elizabeth.
Yeah, so they started to focus on this couple, they were also working on this evidence that they discovered. They didn't find any murder weapons.
No.
But they do have blood evidence. This is in the 1980s. So what they have is blood type.
Yeah, that's it.
And they find A, AB, B, and O blood. They find four different blood types, which if they think Jens and Elizabeth had something to do with this crime, and then you have a couple that were killed, that's four blood types right there.
Yeah.
So right away, it starts to look like maybe they have something.
Absolutely. And that puts two perpetrators at the scene of the crime.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
They ended up finding the different blood types in different areas. Since Jens won't submit to fingerprinting and blood testing, they can't actually test him against their evidence, right?
Well, I think we established that when he fled to Europe.
No, but I'm saying, like, talking about that now, though, since they can't, Do you think that just puts him more on their radar? Because They're like, well, look, you're running away from us and you're not submitting to testing. What do you have to hide?
Well, this is like OJ fleeing in his Bronco. It's going to put all the focus on him and Elizabeth.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing because you're talking about privacy. But sometimes when you're protecting one right, you might be giving up all the rest of yours. You know, I mean, and by doing what he did, it's 2020 is hindsight. But this is not a good moment for him because I think it really gets them focused on him in a way that's even more intense than it already was.
They know that a hunting knife was used, and they end up actually pulling over or detaining a couple men that were in the area that had knives on them, right?
I know that one of the men had a knife and had stuck it into the cushion of the police car because when they had been pulled over, the police officer would put one of them in his patrol car and then speak to the other one. And then he would swap them so he could talk to the other one. And he did this so, you know, he wouldn't have to control two people outside of his patrol car.
But one of them decided to stick the knife into the seat in the back of the patrol car.
And they found it later. So these guys had a hunting knife on them. And not only that, but these same two guys would end up killing a homeless man not too long after, I think within a month.
Not great guys. And they were in the area and one of them dumped a weapon.
Yeah, dumped a weapon. I don't know that they did anything. That's, we don't know. Mm-hmm. That's the mystery of it. They were picked up. They were really close to this house, really.
And it's possible that these just were two guys doing their thing and he didn't want to get in trouble for having a knife on him, although I'm not sure how much trouble you can get in, but hey, we've seen some pretty gnarly things happen with people with a knife on them. This is just one aspect of suspects in the area, but again, Jens is their prime focus.
But like I said, they did end up murdering a man with a knife later on. It's very questionable.
So Jens and Elizabeth go to London. They are living off writing bad checks. They do a scam where they buy some really expensive clothing with a bad check, and then they'll take that piece of clothing and return it to another store that's, you know, a chain, and then get cash back for the return. They end up getting passports, fake IDs. They go to Thailand for a while, but that doesn't work out for them for whatever reason, and they end up coming back to London. So they head over to Canterbury. They're pulling their scam where somebody writes a bad check and then they go to return the items. And the cashier thinks there's something suspicious about this. And they have an undercover cop on site. She informs him and he stops our dynamic duo.
Yeah, when they were doing this check writing scheme, since the checks would take till the end of the week to clear, they were literally able to cash all these fake checks, which they had over 100 of them. They made a profit of £6,000.
This isn't just we need food to get by on. This is they're going to town having a night out. So this undercover cop approaches them. They're giving fake names. And the cop is pretty much done with their story and says, you need to come with me. And he takes them down to the station. Not only does he figure out who they are, but he finds the murder charge back in the States. And he will make a phone call back to our investigators. Are you looking for these two? And has Elizabeth's parents been murdered? And the investigators will confirm all the events and buy plane tickets to fly out to England. The cops back in the States have done a press conference indicating that they've issued indictments for both Jens and Elizabeth for the murder of her parents. Well, hold on. This is sort of interesting. They say they've issued indictments for Jens and Elizabeth for the murder of their parents, which it's only Elizabeth's parents. It's not their parents. We would get a hateful email if we got that fact wrong. At the time that they are caught in England, Elizabeth actually breaks up with Jens and says that she's going to go back to the States and she's going to admit to her part in her parents' murder. And she's going to make a deal with the investigator. His name's Updike. And she's leaving Jens high and dry. Jens is not coming back to the States. He's saying that he's going to fight extradition. But where he's at, the legal system hasn't exactly charged him with anything, so they're not allowing him access to a solicitor, which is his attorney. So he's sort of in this legal limbo while he's being detained in England. He's asking for an attorney, but they're not giving him one because they're saying, well, your charges are in America, not here, so we don't have to give you anything. That's his words. I'm just kind of repeating what he said. But he's under the impression that he has diplomatic immunity and that he can't be charged with a serious crime in the States. Now, before you freak out and say he's dumb and that's not correct, I know. Elizabeth is now back in the States and the investigators are telling him, we're going to give her the electric chair. She's going to get the death penalty, Old Smoky. She's done for. Now, Jens is in love. This is his partner in crime that he's been on the run with. They've gone through a lot together. And he's thinking, well, I can't let that happen to her. I'm a foreign diplomat or something, whatever his thought process is. So I'm going to go back to the States and confess so she doesn't get the electric chair. And then I will be deported back to Germany, my home country, where I'll face charges there, but I won't face charges in America because I have this immunity. Now, just because you're from another country and you're visiting another country, you know, if you're German and you're visiting the United States, or you're a United States citizen and you're vacationing in Mexico, you are not a diplomat. You are not a representative of the American government. You have no immunity. But Jens, because he hasn't talked to a lawyer, he doesn't know this. He's being an armchair lawyer here, thinking, oh, well, they can't do anything to me, so I'm going to go ahead and go back. He agrees to the extradition and tells the investigators, I'm going to confess. The U.S. law enforcement sends the indictment and the extradition order over to the English government, but they don't put any charges in there, I guess. It's sort of a legal thing, I guess. I don't know. And the English government saying, well, if they're not charging you with anything, then we can't approve this extradition request. So Jens literally confesses to murder to the English government in order for this extradition process to go through so he can be sent back to the States. So he's confessed twice now. He's told the United States government, I did this, and he's telling the English government, I did this, send me back.
The trial began June 1st, 1990, but it was July 7th, 1989, when there was a ruling that said, we can send Jens back to the U.S., but they are not in favor of the death penalty. So as long as they swear that they're not going to put the death penalty on the table, they will extradite him to the U.S. And that happens.
He's being interrogated by the detectives and the state back in D.C. Now, the investigator, Gardner, he asks Jens, would you consider, under the circumstances, taking into account your answer, pleading guilty to something you didn't do? And Jens replies, I can't say for sure now, but I can see it happening, yes. I think it is a possibility. I think it happens in real life. Meaning, false confessions happen all the time, is what Jens is saying. And he kind of alluded to, I might say something I didn't do, or I might confess to it. The investigator says, I disagree with you, but don't let's get into any legal arguments now. I'm sorry. I think you answered my question. So he's responding, I disagree with you that false confessions happen, is how I read that. So Yin says, I mean, you know, I couldn't answer the question right now. I hope very much that it's not going to come to something like that. Meaning, I hope that I don't have to make a false confession. It's a little bit of a loose pre-confession to a false confession, but I think we've nailed other people for saying, oh, I remember that girl and hanging out with her that night. Yeah, I took care of her. If we take that as a confession to murder, then what Jens just said, I'm going to make a false confession. And the very next day, he confesses to everything. And Elizabeth has struck a plea deal. She's going to get 90 years in prison. So 45 years, her father and her mother, you know, 45 per victim. And she's not going to get the death penalty for now being a witness for the state to testify against Jens.
After a certain amount of time, she will be eligible for parole.
Yeah, yeah. She has a chance to get out.
There's a contrast here. I don't know. Her confession is pretty brief. It's just, yeah, I was involved, right? Basically. Whereas Jens is more or less having to tell them details.
Yeah, absolutely. Her confession is more or less, he hated my parents because they were controlling and abusive, and he took it upon himself to go murder them. He bought me a ticket to these movies as my alibi for not being there while he went to my parents' house and murdered them by himself.
So her confession is more of a confession that she's making for him.
Yeah.
And she's saying basically the only thing she did wrong was she kind of looked the other way.
Basically, I mean, sure, other people can find a lot more to her story, but in a nutshell, that's it.
How very helpful.
And when Jens understands the gravity of the situation and understands that she is going to be testifying against him, well, now he's like, well, I don't have to take a fall for her now. I don't have to go on with this story because she's not getting the electric chair and now she's turned on me. So Jens is saying, everything I told you, not true. And I'm going to do a 180 on my story here.
Let's take a moment, though, and we don't have to go through all the evidence, but when he gave details of how the murders occurred, he didn't really seem to know what he was talking about.
He gets the murder weapon wrong. He's talking about how he killed them with his butterfly knife. Anyone that knows what a butterfly knife is, it's cool thing that we all thought was the hip knife to have in high school, and you'd flip it around your wrists and stuff, but it has a metal handle. We all know that when you're stabbing somebody, from past cases, not personal experience, that you can injure yourself. That knife will slip and you'll end up cutting yourself. And we know that the perpetrators of this crime had cut themselves because their blood was left behind also. So he's saying that he stabbed them with a butterfly knife, but he doesn't have any wounds on his hand. Now, this is, you know, a year later when they're questioning him and he's going to trial and whatnot, but right after the murder, there was no record of any injuries on him. Meanwhile, he gets the locations of the bodies correct, but he gets their positioning completely wrong.
He also got wrong when he described what Nancy Hasem was wearing, completely wrong.
Yeah.
He said she was wearing blue jeans or something.
And an interesting thing is he's got the murder weapon wrong. He's got all these details wrong. Also, it is said that he was there by himself, but we know there's two assailants. So this whole story is kind of a catastrophe, if you could put it that way. The other problem is he bought movie tickets throughout the day for different movies, and he knows the times for all those movies and has the movie tickets to prove it. Elizabeth gets all the movie times wrong, and the only movie she's really that on about is the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is the midnight showing. How do you get that one wrong? But she doesn't get the other ones right. So Elizabeth doesn't know the movie times, and Jens doesn't know the crime scene. Just chew on that for a minute.
Jens said that Elizabeth wasn't with him, that she had actually gone back to take drugs to her dealer, who was also a student at University of Virginia, because she had a debt that she needed to settle. To cover for her, he buys the tickets. So there's a record of movie tickets being purchased.
So nobody's going to the movies then.
Well, at least he went to the movies, he says. But he's buying the extra tickets so that it looks like she's with him, at least on a record. But he's saying it's to protect her because she had already skipped school before and left with another woman and went to Europe on a spree there. He thinks he's covering for her, but did he know what she was really doing?
I mean, why are you covering for somebody that's hanging out with a drug dealer? I don't know why you would have to go buy movie tickets to cover for that. That's just, oh, you're going to take off for a few hours? Cool. I think he has a little bit more insight to the events of the night if he's actually trying to form an alibi. Because I don't think you go buy a bunch of movie tickets for, oh, you're going on a drug run. That's... you just go on a drug run.
Yeah, because my thought was, let's say her parents, and of course, they're alive in this scenario, but if they're asking, where were you? Then she could just say, I was at the movies. And then Jens could say, oh yeah, we saw these movies.
I don't really see buying movie tickets to prove to parents.
Right.
I mean, if they're mad at her for not coming home, they're mad at her for not coming home. And it has no bearing on where she was.
Right. So to me, the only reason you have to buy extra tickets is if you're covering for someone who's going to commit a real crime. Now, you could say the drug thing is a crime, but You could do that on the sly.
Also, Jens has to get a cash advance. And I'm not sure if he wrote a check or if he ran a credit card to get this cash advance, but he does it at the hotel that they're staying at.
It was a check.
So there's a record of him getting this cash advance from the hotel. Now, the timestamp is not legible, so we can't really use it as, well, they were murdered at this time and he was not there. But again, their bodies weren't found for...
3-4 days.
Yeah, 3-4 days. So we can't really say they were murdered at this time and he wasn't there or so-and-so wasn't there because we don't know what time they were murdered at. But at least he's somewhere in DC buying movie tickets and getting cash advances, not Elizabeth. That's in his favor.
The question would be, if he's establishing an alibi, wouldn't it just stand to reason if she was committing murder that that's when it happened?
Absolutely.
It's kind of an assumption, but...
It's a no-brainer, really. So they have these contradicting narratives. And we really have three narratives here. We have the state's narrative that they were together murdering her parents. We have Elizabeth's narrative that she was watching the movies and he was off avenging her and killing her parents. And then we have his narrative, which is, I gave a false confession to save my girlfriend's life, and now I'm retracting that and telling you that I was the one at the movies and buying these tickets, and she was the one that was off in the rental car.
And he did seem to have a better account of what he was doing there than she did in DC.
Absolutely. And the car, the rental car that was in her name, had the amount of miles that it would take to drive to her parents' house and back.
Well, and when she was asked about that, she said that the extra mileage occurred because she and Jens had gotten lost.
In DC. For hours? Mm-hmm. For hundreds of miles.
Apparently. Apparently.
I think a better explanation would be we were driving around looking at the monuments or something, but I can see making a wrong turn here and there, but yeah. Jens goes to trial. His whole defense is, I didn't do this. My whole confession was to protect Elizabeth, and Elizabeth is the culprit here. Now, Elizabeth's testimony is challenged a bit because her other siblings, two brothers, take the stand and testify against her, saying she is absolutely capable of this. She is a sociopath, a compulsive liar. There's all kinds of things that are coming out now that her siblings obviously don't like her and don't trust her. When it comes to the evidence at the crime, they find the blood types, and Jens happens to be type O. So 1980s, well, that's a match. As good as it's going to get.
Hey, that, yeah. It's essentially like that. But, you know, he's the one that fought giving that over. He didn't want them to have his blood. And, well, the funny thing about this, though, and I don't know if it's really funny, but they had every blood type at the scene. So what were the odds that his blood type would be found?
That's like playing the roulette table and betting on black, betting on red, betting on odds, betting on evens. Like, you're going
to
win.
But... it's going to be one of those yeah. things, but right.
Yeah. Another bit of evidence is a bloody sock print, which is a huge point of contention with this case because most of the bloody footprints were wiped up around the bodies, but they were able to find a few more in the other parts of the house. And this bloody sock print, they say, is Jens's footprint, essentially, because they don't think it's Elizabeth's. Now, Jens's defense is going to say, that's not the right size. You know, you can't say that that's my client's sock, but I guess he's out of order with it. His defense attorney is not following process very well. So he's not getting his objections in correctly or not questioning expert witnesses or investigators in the proper manner. So some of these very pivotal moments in the trial do not go in Jens's favor because his defense attorney is, I guess, dropping the ball. He has a good point. He's trying to fight this evidence. He's trying to question this evidence. But since he didn't do it in the proper order, the defense doesn't get their say and the prosecution gets their evidence in against Jens.
And speaking of the sock print, the prosecution could have used the state labs analyst, who was Rick Johnson, to testify about this evidence, but I think they didn't like what he had to say. So they decided to bring in someone who was known as a freelancer, Robert Hallett. He used to work at an FBI lab as a tech and had worked on tire and belt impressions.
Oh, that's exactly the same as a bloody sock print.
But what else does a sock print, I mean, what is it known for? Right? It's a sock.
Yeah, it's not like you're checking ridges and the fingerprint or something. There's, you know, how are you getting a match out of this?
It doesn't make any sense, really. Now, what I do believe is you could measure the sock print. And this is what's understood is that that state lab analyst would have said, I measured it and it's too small for Jens.
Because Jens is about an 8.5 size and this sock print is more like a 6.
Yeah, I think it's between a 5.5 and a 6.5.
Okay, yeah. Very small.
That's a lot smaller. And so they can't use that. So what they do is they bring in someone else who does what?
He overlays a transparent photo of Jens's bloody sock print that he did in a test on top of the bloody sock print from the scene of the crime. And it matches perfectly.
There you go. He was there, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's very impressionable to a jury. It's very prejudicial when this transparency aligns perfectly over the sock print. Although I'm just thinking you could enlarge it, enlarge the photo of the actual evidence to match his sock print. Or you could downsize it whichever way you want to do it.
In other words, you could get your conviction or you could jeopardize getting a conviction here.
This is not science. This should not have been admissible at all. But there might have been something to the defense not following proper objections and the prosecution using Joe Schmo to enlarge a photo to match Jens's footprint.
That's not the only thing, because as you said, it appeared as though someone may have wiped up a lot of prints at the scene, but they had some shoe impressions in blood, and Jens was known to wear sneakers. But that's what they're doing, is they're saying, oh, well, he's known to wear sneakers, and now there are sneaker tread prints in the blood. We've got him. But then again, once they measure them, they measure what?
Not the right size.
Way
smaller.
Yeah. Isn't there someone that these kind of do match the size?
I would say Elizabeth. She's a 5.5 to a 6.5. She's got a smaller foot. So weird. I think that kind of puts her at the crime scene, but this evidence isn't being used against her. It's being used against Jens. And this is always a interesting dual narrative that I see prosecutors use. They can literally charge two different people for the same murder and place the gun in each one of their hands and say, they're the trigger man, and play that out in two separate trials and convict two separate people for pulling the trigger. They can just do that. This is a similar situation where they're using evidence that doesn't match Jens against him, but it does match somebody else. It's kind of a weird situation.
So they're basically using what evidence they have against Jens, even though it really doesn't work. But you know how it is. If you're giving the jury a certain impression and it's being uncontested, then it goes, right?
Yeah. Jens flew in on a flying unicorn and killed her parents by stabbing him with the unicorn horn. And if it's not objected to, the jury has to decide on that fact.
So long as they believe in unicorns.
It doesn't really matter.
The other thing I understand occurred was that before Jens had gone to America, he was feeling pretty confident that he understood how everything worked and that he felt somewhat protected because he was a German citizen.
Yeah, but he was wrong.
He was wrong, but he had stated to Elizabeth, he said, "Don't worry about a thing with Bedford County authorities." And this is where he was supposed to be sent back to. He said, "Those yokels don't know what's coming down." That's what he wrote to her.
Yeah.
And so at trial, they were basically throwing that back at him, saying, "Look at this guy. He thinks we're all idiots over here. This is his mindset. Not only is this guy the murderer, but he's also pretty full of himself."
Well, when they misspeak to an entire press conference about whose parents it is, I kind of don't blame his wording.
But still, I mean, this is his life on trial.
Yeah.
And they will use anything and everything against you. This is just one slip up that they were able to use against him quite effectively at trial. But I mean, it just goes to show how everything you say can and will be used against you.
Now, when it comes to fingerprints that were found at the crime scene, none of them match him. So all they have really going against him is his confession, a bloody sock print, and a blood type comparison.
Yeah, it almost seems like they don't really care about what really happened because they've got someone they can nail to the wall for it.
Well, he fled, so he's the guy.
Speaking of the fingerprints, both Derek and Nancy had a pretty high alcohol content in their blood. There was a liquor bottle, I think it was a vodka bottle there, that had prints on it, and there were glasses with prints on them. And exactly like you said, none of them matched Jens.
Weird. Elizabeth recounts the night with Jens driving off to her parents' house while she's at the movie theater, and Jens comes back with a bloody sheet wrapped around him, and there's blood all over the car. This is her memory of the night. So Jens is now returned from murdering her parents, and he's stripped off his clothes, and he's wearing a bloody sheet, and there's blood everywhere. Yet the rental car does not have blood all over it, and this bloody sheet was never found. They even luminoled the rental car. No blood.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
When Jens had given a confession, this is what he said as far as the details of the murders. He said that he had been talking to Elizabeth about her parents and about the problem of them because, you know, they didn't like him. And apparently they were abusive towards Elizabeth. So that can't stand. And he said that he visited her parents' home while she went and purchased tickets to several movies. He said that Derek answered the door, invited Jens in. They started drinking together. His wife joined them at the table. He said that as they were talking and drinking, an argument started. It culminated with them threatening to have him expelled from the university if he kept seeing their daughter. So Jens said he got up to leave, and as he got up, her father slammed him against the wall, and he hit his head. So he grabbed a knife, he struck at Derek, and cut open his neck. Then they were fighting, and he was stabbing, And Yen said, Nancy, Elizabeth's mom, came at him with a knife that she had, and he took it away from her. And then while he was using her as a shield, he was actually slashing at Derek and at Nancy. So this is how supposedly he was able to attack both of them, is because he was being attacked himself. He said that the last thing that he really remembers was that he was throwing tableware and the knives and his clothing into a dumpster at the end of the road. So I guess he had gone there to try and fix things, clear things up, and they really didn't want him in the picture anymore. And that's his confession.
And violence breaks out at the dinner table. He goes to kill the father, and the mom picks up a knife, and they're in a melee knife fight, and he grabs a hold of her. Yeah. Okay.
He almost makes it sound like it's self-defense in a way, because he went there not trying to kill them, but violence erupted because Derek got physical with him. We know that someone wore footwear in there, but that we also know that someone was in their socks. And he claims that he ended up taking his shoes off and he used his socks to walk around and smear any kind of footprints he found. So he would use his socks to kind of swirl the prints away. And then because he got rid of all the evidence, like his clothing and his, you know, anything else he had, that's why he was wrapped in a sheet, which fits her account, because she said he showed up in a sheet, a bloody sheet. I mean, that's a pretty good confession, even if he gets a lot of details wrong. In some of the most damning respects, it seems like it kind of hits it on the head.
It's possible that he's telling the truth and he's just getting a lot of details wrong. Or it's possible that somebody told him what the details were so he could come up with the explanation. He's a smart guy. It's not that hard for him to lie.
But again, this is the confession. And of course, he later recanted that and said he had made it all up.
So if we analyze the evidence here, all the jury knows is there's a blood type match, there's a bloody sock match, and this guy confessed and he's a liar. So you can't believe his recanting of the story. And Elizabeth is untrustworthy because she has these claims that her parents were abusive towards her. And there were even nude photographs that they found of her that it said either Nancy or the father took of her. More or less, the mother is where the rumor comes from. And the judge and prosecution are saying there is no evidence of your parents abusing you, and you just murdered them for a life insurance policy or money or whatever. They were too controlling of you, and they didn't like your boyfriend. So that's their motive. But this is all the jury has to go on. They've discredited Elizabeth, and all the evidence is against Jens, and it's physical evidence that they've gotten through to the jury. So what's their verdict?
They find him guilty.
He's given pretty much the same sentence, right? 45 years for each victim, 90-year sentence. He is eligible for parole after, I think, 22 years or something to that effect. Now, Jens is not going down without a fight. He is not happy about this sentence, this verdict. So he's been fighting his conviction ever since. But he's got a lot of free time in prison. So does Elizabeth. He's been writing books. He's been petitioning the government and doing everything he can, right?
Yeah, this is a guy that is very, very outspoken about his innocence in this case.
Now, he tried to make a deal with the governor to get not a pardon, not an exoneration, but to be paroled and then sent back to Germany, expelled from the United States, never to return. And the governor pretty much agreed to it, but he lost the election. A new governor is in town, And Elizabeth comes out and starts talking about this case and how Jens had manipulated her and just really bad stuff. And this new governor doesn't hold to the end of the bargain because he doesn't care about Jens or anything. He thinks, well, this guy's a murderer and he's sitting in prison. Screw him. We're good. So Jens had a window of opportunity to get out and go back to Germany, but he was denied that. He's had between 8 and 10 parole hearings, but to get paroled, to get released from prison, you have to admit guilt. You have to show remorse. You have to show some sort of, I guess, rehabilitation. But in order to do that, you have to admit guilt. He's not admitting guilt. He's saying, I didn't do this. By the way, guy's been in prison for 27 plus years. Not one disciplinary incident on his record. Not one. So looking at this and saying, he's been up for parole, nothing on his record. Why is he being denied? If it's all about rehabilitation, if it's all about protecting society from a threat, is this guy a threat? Apparently, the parole board thinks he is.
Well, and we know how this works. And I'm not going to say that all of them are this way, but it seems like a great number of them want you to say, I deeply regret what happened, right? They want you to say you're sorry somehow, show regret. The only thing he seems sorry for is that because he lied when he made his confession, that he put the family through more pain. Mm-hmm. It just stretched everything out and it changed, you know, the whole story. Now he's involved and then later he's going to recant, which we know what effect that has on family members of murder victims. They feel as though, you know, when justice was coming, now it might get taken away because now this person who had confessed is now fighting to say, no, I didn't mean it. I was lying then. So the best thing for these families is just to have justice move forward. So Jens does seem to have sympathy for them, but yeah, in this case, he's not going to say that he did it because he's adamant that he didn't.
Before we get into more evidence and more details that arise later, I'm just looking at the situation and thinking it costs tens of thousands up to 50 grand a year to keep people incarcerated. He has a lot of supporters, even back in Germany. If he were to be deported and sent back there, he has a support system, and we wouldn't have to pay for this guy with our tax dollars. I'm thinking that's kind of a win-win. It's obvious that he's not a threat to society, but he's definitely not going to be a threat to our society because he won't be here. He'll be whisked away on a plane immediately. I'm kind of the opinion that I don't really care if this guy's guilty or not. He's been in prison for a long time with no issues. Send him away.
Right, but you know, there are people who would look at this and say, you know, if he did this, he brutally stabbed two people to death. So just because he's been put away for almost 3 decades, well, maybe that's not enough time. Maybe he should never be out. And if we send him to Germany, well, they may just let him go free. And then where's the justice then?
Now, an interesting thing came up. There was a man by the name of Buchanan, who owns a car shop, who was following this case. And he remembers the rental car being brought in to his shop by a woman and a man. And he knows that woman was Emily. And the man was a very tall, slender man with a highlight in his hair. Now, Buchanan will claim that he followed the case, but he wasn't really paying that much attention because these people fled the United States. So he just assumed, well, they're the guilty party. They took off. When they extradited them back to the States a year or two later, that's the first time he saw a picture of Jens. He knew that's not the person I saw with her that day. Also, the car that was brought in, it wasn't just like a car was brought in and then he never saw it again or didn't touch it. There was a whole rigmarole at this car where this woman brings it in with a man. There happens to be a bloody knife in the car. And then they clean the car up, but they're not sure who the car belongs to because it's a rental. So they're having to call a bank to verify ownership. And then they're having to ask who's going to pay for the cleanup, who's going to get the authorization here. It was a big headache to him.
It shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
If you get a rental car and there's blood inside of it and a bloody hunting knife, maybe you should be turning that car over to the police, right? I mean, why do you need to clean it at that point? That I just don't get it, I guess.
He was saying something to the effect of, if I had known what the deal was, I would have called police right off the bat. He says that he tried calling one of the investigators to report this and left a message, never heard back. And then years later, after Jens is being found guilty and all this other stuff, the judge from the trial is doing a speech at it's like an airborne veterans group or something to that effect. And Buchanan asks him a question during his speech because he's talking about the trial and brings this up. And the judge has no idea what he's talking about. And so they have a whole conversation and he says, I think I saw Elizabeth and a strange man dropping this car off. And I swear to you, it was not Jens. But this lead never went anywhere. Now, it's obvious that the guy didn't report anything at the time that the car was dropped off years later when he finally saw a photo of Jens. So not the best lead to try to hunt down. But the guy's gone on record and given a statement, affidavit. I don't know why he would make it up. He's not really making $1 million off the story or anything. I know some people lie to get, you know, their 15 seconds of fame, but this just seems so random.
Well, it's just crazy to me that did they dispose of this knife? I mean, it's crazy to me. They had the murder weapon probably, right?
Yeah.
That's what it seems to be the case anyway. The other thing is if someone said that they know the person they saw was not Jens, I believe them because Jens is very distinctive, mm-hmm. right? He has those glasses and he has what's been described as Mick Jagger lips. That's how I've read it in these articles anyway online. You know, he has a distinctive look. And so if there was someone else that was with Elizabeth and someone said, yeah, it's not Jens, I believe them. Because I think you could get clothing wrong, color of a car wrong, but man, when you're looking at someone's face and someone looks that distinctive...
I'm not going to say that I don't think Jens would be capable of this, but the dude's not that intimidating. He wears what I call BC glasses and is just not very threatening. BC is what we called them in the military. They're ugly glasses, birth control glasses, because nobody's going to want to sleep with you if you're wearing them. sorry. He's just not that ferocious. He's very unintimidating. But we know two people did this, and we have to assume that it was him and Elizabeth. Now we're looking at the evidence. It's not really coming up. Oh, and then we find out that that blood type, the blood evidence that was at the scene, they were able to do DNA testing much later. They get a DNA profile off that type O, and it doesn't match Jens. And at that point, I'm really thinking, this is reasonable doubt. You have nothing.
Well, if you're trying to be responsible, right? By the way, when they tested the blood, Nancy and Derek, their blood types were A and AB, not necessarily in that order. Type O blood was considered to be the killers.
But the DNA doesn't seem to match.
Right. The DNA is not a match.
You have a confession that doesn't match. You have a made-up bloody sock print match, which is not scientific and is pretty much a downright, it's downright a lie. It doesn't even come close to his shoe size.
And, well, the guy that gave the testimony about that had been shown to assist in wrongfully convicting a man who went away for 18 years on death row before he was exonerated by DNA. So, I mean, this guy had used a shoe print in the past and said it was this guy, and it wasn't actually a match, but he somehow convinced the jury it was.
So what do we have against Jens at this point? The blood doesn't match him. The footprint doesn't match him.
The shoe print doesn't match him.
There's nothing tying this dude to the crime. That's, I think that that calls for a retrial. And I'm not sure what the state or the prosecution would do in a retrial because they have nothing.
Yeah, you go back through that evidence and you have to say, okay, so the sock print, it's too small. The shoe print, too small. The blood doesn't fit him. The DNA doesn't fit him. The fingerprints don't fit him. Oh, and he has kind of a good alibi because he named off the movies he went and saw. He talked about the check that he cashed or however he got that cash advance. He has a pretty good story about where he was, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of doubt here now. Really, without the confession, there would be nothing here other than suspicion. That's not enough.
And when you think about the confession, he actually told the investigators, I'm going to give you a false confession. I mean, it wasn't that clear, but he alluded to it definitely. And I realized that this is the Jens narrative. This is absolutely his defense and his supporters' narrative. But when it comes to what makes the most sense or what the evidence supports, I fall more on his side in this case and not on Elizabeth's side. At the time, she was said to have been using a lot of drugs. She had this drugged out boyfriend, drug dealer on the side. And that drug dealing boyfriend had a highlight in his hair. He also had a father who I guess was either a judge or somebody in a high official capacity who the judge that presided over this trial knew. He also was friends with Elizabeth's family, and he did not recuse himself. And then it turns out that Jens's lawyer was having a slow mental breakdown during the time of the trial and would end up getting either disbarred or no longer practicing law shortly thereafter. And all of a sudden, you think of the way he mishandled at least the process and protocols of a trial. And you think, well, that kind of fits now. I won't say that he had a terrible defense because I think the guy did bring up valid points. Just he couldn't get them through because he wasn't following procedure.
The other thing to note would be when he was being questioned before he was ever extradited. This is when he was in England. He asked for a lawyer, but they denied him. And then he ended up signing away his right to an attorney. According to Jens, it was because they had made some mention of some harm coming to Elizabeth.
Yeah, they were threatening.
They deny that. But according to Jens, he asked for a lawyer and then ended up signing away because his concern was Elizabeth, the love of his life.
If we take him at his word, you can see his infatuation here. You can see why he would put himself in harm's way to give a false confession for her, especially if he's signing away his rights for an attorney because he thinks that something's going to happen to her.
Which falls in line with that idea that you had talked about before of she's kind of out of his league and he's just so enamored with her. And that's one of the questions I had coming into this was she really ever enamored with him? And I mean, what was your thought on that?
I think she was. I mean, they spent a lot of time together. They wrote all those love letters back and forth. But I think she's in the moment kind of a person. And you'll do for now. Sure, she was in love with him at that time. But that love dwindled and she no longer had a use for him. she just didn't seem to be the type of person to settle down with anyone, even with that love letter she had left him.
So where are they at now?
Well, as of a couple of years ago, at least, we've seen some former investigators, former police officers coming forward and supporting Yen Tsering.
Even one of the investigators on this case who absolutely believed he was guilty.
Yeah, and that's because when you go back over the evidence, especially due to the DNA testing, the investigators have made a big point of saying this, that you can't just hold to your original ideas if they don't work anymore. And in this case, it appears as though the prosecution did not give him a fair trial. I know it's not really up to them. The judge should have been there, or the defense should have been there, but this was not a fair trial. And so when you can lie about the sock, saying that it's the right size and that he left it and the type of blood fits him, I mean, you can't excuse all these things away.
But with the DNA evidence, you know, new information has come to light and you have to go back and reevaluate. Was Jens now just a getaway driver while Elizabeth and another assailant went in and killed everybody? Because Jens wasn't in that house. Somebody else was.
Yeah, this is something that we've talked about before, but with the justice system, the reason so many people don't believe in it is because it has failed time after time. And I'm not saying all the time, but how many times does it have to fail and have the justice system double down on their failure before we have to say, come on? What we'd all like to see is a justice system that says, oh, wait a minute, we have evidence that shows you probably weren't the person. I mean, this doesn't fit you, that doesn't fit you, the DNA doesn't work. I mean, when are they going to say, okay, maybe we made a mistake here, let's at least look at it? Because it seems like there's a lot of digging in that happens to protect their conviction.
I almost feel as if they admit wrongdoing, they think people would lose faith in the system. But I love it when people admit that they're wrong and change their way and are accountable for their mistakes.
It's therapeutic.
Yeah.
Right? How many more people would believe in the system if they even believed for a moment that there was a chance that they'd be willing to go back and say, yeah, this maybe wasn't a good conviction?
And in a lot of instances, especially with Alfred pleas and other things, the state can say, oh, well, yeah, you are actually innocent, but we didn't do anything wrong. We did not deny you any of your constitutional rights because we dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. We followed procedure, and it's not our fault. A jury of your peers found you guilty. Again, they've completely sidestepped any responsibility for a wrongful conviction.
What I do appreciate, though, is that you have former investigators, former police officers coming forward and saying, seriously, this is worth looking at. This is probably an innocent man sitting in prison right now. I love that. It shows that you can't just say, oh, the entire justice system is screwed up. No, we have people coming forward who are trying to assist Jens in seeking his release. And I mean, I don't know how this comes off to everyone else, but he keeps saying, I just want to go back to Germany.
So now you go back to that offer he made. I don't even want an exoneration. Just let me go. I will leave and go back to Germany. Sounds like a good deal, because now the state does not have to admit any wrongdoing. All they have to do is parole him, which he's been eligible for almost a decade.
Remember before when I said people will be upset because here's a guy that may have murdered two people pretty brutally and 27 years, whatever it was, that's not good enough. But now we have a lot of evidence that, heck, he wasn't even there, right?
Yeah.
So at this point, now it does start to sound like a good idea, at least to me.
Yeah, I don't want to pay for this guy to be incarcerated another 45 years or however long he lives for.
If they were just to release him, he's not even going to be a pain in their ass anymore. He's just going to leave.
Yeah. It's a win-win.
I don't know. This just, the digging in and the doubling down bothers me. And I'm not trying to slam all prosecutors. Again, let's just take Bedford County. I'm just trying to say, in this case in particular, this is just ridiculous. This is terrible. And this is the kind of thing that causes people to lose faith in their justice system.
It's an outlier. You know, most cases don't even go to trial. It's like less than 3% go to trial. And then of those that go to trial, they get to plea deals and whatnot. And I'm sure that 99% of people that are charged with crimes are probably the perpetrators of said crime. But when it comes to the most heinous crime of murder, I would just expect a little bit more. And I realize that this was the 1980s, and we have a lot more tools now with DNA and whatnot, but we see murder trials today that are not so clear. And here we are, right back at where we started. Will the state ever admit when they're wrong? And if they do, great, but wrongful convictions need to be addressed. And hey, I would rather be charged in America than any other country. Don't get me wrong. But if I was wrongfully convicted here, I would have zero faith that that wrong would be righted ever.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.